The Utah Open Source Foundation brings the Utah Logs home. Feel free to listen live at stream.utos.org or catch the audio afterward at podcast.utos.org. The bandwidth is provided by Center 7. The following presentation, Practical Puppet Systems Building Systems, was given on March 14, 2009 by Andrew Schaefer at the Ubuntu Utah User Group. Visit their site at utah.ubuntu-us.org.
My name is Andrew Schaefer. I work on Puppet, which is a automation framework. It's GPL'd. It's all written in Ruby. It's an external DSL. Most sysadmins who use it start to like it, so you've been warned. This is how we're going to start. We're going to talk about testing all the effing time. Some other place I'd probably swear more, but I'm going to swear less. So I'm going to talk about code, I'm going to talk about tribes, I'm going to talk about the dawn of time, I'm going to talk about clouds, I'm going to talk about evolution, and I'm going to talk about opportunity and triumph. Not necessarily in that order. So like I said, this is Andrew Schaefer, and I'm the proud father of two beautiful boys. I like mathematics, I work for Reductive Labs, and I work on a project called Puppet, which, as I said before, is an automation framework. So let's start at the beginning. No, before that.
Punch cards.
So a long time ago, there wasn't computer science. There was people that wanted to compute. And they had math and physics problems they wanted to solve. And for a short period of time, the people that ran the computers and understood the systems were the same people that programmed them. And right now I'm talking to sysadmins, but earlier I gave this exact same talk to developers. And at some point, they separated, right? And that period, that first period, will probably last about 10 minutes. And you know, then we had the separation and the internet became used for porn, and now we're here. So we're going to look at code. This is Puppet code. I just showed you guys this same code before. If you're hearing this, you can't see it. Hopefully, the slides will be available. This is the definition for installing Ruby on Rails. And this is all code I wrote in the last 2-3 days. And we're going to walk through it. Hopefully, it will make sense by the end. So this is saying Rails site, the name that's being passed in is the next big thing, and the server name, which is going to end up being set up as a virtual server in the Apache conf, which we'll see by the end, is tnbt.com, the next big thing.com. I don't even know if that resolves. I didn't even check. And we have to install Rails version 2.2 because our app that we want to install wants to run that. If you're installing Rails, you know what a pain it is to try to, you know, deal with the versioning issues. So it's all written in Ruby, but it's not Ruby. It's an external DSL. And if you're a Rubyist, that probably hurts you, but deal with it. We just won an award. This is the person who wrote Ruby. I don't know if you know much. This was originally formatted for a Ruby conference, and this is the primary author of Ruby, Matsumoto Yukihiro. He is an artist, seriously. Ruby is a work of art, and it makes a lot of people happy. It makes me personally happy, and if you don't know Ruby, you should get acquainted with it because it is very beautiful. And he was the judge for this award that was in Japan, and he awarded Puppet a rating of excellent, so which that was the second award, and they gave us a check for I think 10,000 yen or something, and a little statue with like a ruby, and like a little. It's like 10,000. Yeah. Oh, no, I'm sorry. It's like 1,000. Okay. The main prize was $10,000, and that went to, which I think might have been $1 million. Yeah, I'm not positive, and I'm tired. Like I, not to make excuses, but the winning prize was a framework for modeling climate from some group in Korea, which sounds like an awesome project. So I don't feel too bad getting like the second place, but that's a tribute to Mats and to Ruby, and you know we love Ruby and we're big in Japan. What can you do?
You're big everywhere.
So back to this code. We're going to install RailSight. We already looked at that. So let's see what that expands to. This is Puppet language again. This is the definition of the RailSight. So since you guys are not Rubyists and you haven't been installing Rails, I'll walk through this with a little more detail to make it all make sense. But if you've installed Rails, like this is what you do all the time. You have to deal with it. What are you going to do? So it's going to install Ruby. It's going to install Gems, which is an alternative package management thing that Ruby does. Apache, a lot of people run Apache as their web server. Passenger is, you can think of that as mod Rails. Like if you do mod anything else, mod PHP, then MySQL is going to be used as the database in this case. You could use Postgres or SQLite or some other crazy database, but MySQL is easy. So we'll do that, and then we're going to install Rails, the Rails setup and Rails install. So we're going to walk through all this code. We're going to expand it and look at it, and we'll keep coming back to this just to kind of get our reference. So moving on, first we're going to look at installing Ruby. So class Ruby, when you say include in a manifest, it's going to look for that class, and then it's going to instantiate it. And what Puppet tries to do is be declarative. So it has this resource model, which is based on nouns, as opposed to if you're scripting things in Bash or Ruby or an imperative language, then you tend to think imperatively. What Puppet's trying to get you to do is think declarative. So you're not thinking about how do I do this, you're thinking about what should it be like? What state should it be in? So you're saying, here I want to install these packages. I want Ruby 1.8, I want the dev, the RDoc, which is a documentation for Ruby, RI, IRB, which is interactive and OpenSSL for Ruby, and you're going to say, ensure that they're installed. Done. It's going to, like we saw before, that's going to expand to apt-get on this particular system. At the bottom of Puppet is this abstraction layer. So if you ran this exact same code on Red Hat, it's going to expand to yum, if that makes sense. So we're back here. The next thing we're going to do is install gems. Now, this gems pack class is not going to install gem packages. It's actually going to install a package manager, the gems package manager. So it's going to go through. These are declarative. It breaks down a little bit when you get to execs. So there's certain times when you're going to essentially shell out. So an exec is, say, run this command on the shell, so you're sort of breaking a little bit out of the declarative paradigm, but sometimes you just got to do it. So here we're going to wget something from RubyForge, which is a tarball with the gems, and I think it's interesting, we'll use the word interesting, that RubyForge is a PHP application. What are you going to do? And here's another note, and I don't know if you guys are thinking about automation too much in your jobs right now, but RubyForge, to get this gem, I have to know this magic number, 45905, to get the Ruby gems 131. Why? I don't know, but I think you're exposing some part of your implementation through that interface that you don't need to, and it makes it difficult for me to automate. So one of the things that would be nice is if I could say restfully, I want version 131 and get it back without knowing this magic number. So if you look at the site and go and look at all the gems for Ruby gems, or not the gems with the tarballs, then you have to know this magic number. And I don't know what you guys work on or exactly what you set up, but think about that kind of stuff. If you're exposing implementation in a way that doesn't need to be, it's going to make either your life or someone else's life potentially harder later, like you're showing off your underwear. And then this next line, creates, is important for something I'm about to spring on you, because you're gonna set up this idempotence. That's something that the other models do for you, but with exec, you have to do that essentially manually. So what that's telling this particular instance of exec is that this command will create this file. That make sense? And then after you get it, you're going to untar it. It's basically the same thing. And then you're setting up an explicit relationship. So you're saying, I can't untar it until I get it. So that's what the require is going to do. And it's actually going to build a directive graph, and there's some crazy stuff that could happen there, but we're not going to get too much into that right now. And then the gems setup, it's going to make sure that it also has Ruby. So the setup is going to depend on untarring the gems, but it's also going to depend on Ruby, so you have to set up that dependency. And then at the end, I'm going to set up a symlink, and I can't set up the symlink until I've run setup. Does that make sense? So let's talk about idempotence. Who knows what idempotence means?
So
idempotence is a mathematical or computer science concept, which means an idempotent, it means that an operation can be performed multiple times and it will only put things into a certain state. And it won't change that state after subsequent operations. So something like adding one, the operation adding one is not an idempotent operation. If I add one to a number, it's now bigger. And I add another one, it's bigger. And another one, it's bigger. In math, a simple idempotent operation would be multiplying by zero. Right? So if I multiply any number by zero, I get a number. That number is zero. And I can multiply it as many times as I want by zero, and it will stay zero. Does that make sense?
Okay.
So what you're doing when you set up these creates is you're saying, perform this operation, but if this runs again, it's not going to do it. Because in this case, it wouldn't really matter. It would just make that file again. But there are certainly scripts, I'm sure you guys have experienced this, if you run the same script twice, it's potentially destructive. And so you set up these conditions that protect you from that based on your understanding of the system. So go back here. We're going to install Apache. This is pretty simple. I have a class Apache. And the class is going to require these packages. I'm sure you guys have run apt-get install Apache before. And I'm also going to set up a service. So this is another one of the resources in the model. This is going to say that make sure Apache is running. And it has restart. Some services, if they're using init, they can restart. Some services on some platforms, you basically do a stop and then a start. So this is like some parameterization to manage the differences between systems. And then this is another define we're going to look at in a second that is going to get rid of the default site that comes with Apache, which might be why it disappeared. So this define I just described to you is going to take essentially one parameter, and then it's going to do a case statement. If that parameter is present, then it's going to run an exec that is... If you guys are managing Ubuntu, I'm pretty sure you've seen this stuff before. It's going to enable the site based on, or disable the site when we get to the absent. And it's only going to run, this is back to the idempotence stuff, if that is not found in grepping, or doing an ls of the directory and grepping the results for that pattern. Does that make sense? And then disable is essentially the opposite. It's going to disable the site if it can find it. That code is pretty, I think the semantics are easy to understand. Yes, Clint?
Site? What do you actually mean?
It's an idiom that Apache 2 uses on Debian distributions to manage virtual hosts.
Oh,
it's well, so what you do is you create a virtual host description in sites available, and then when you run, when you run this command, it symlinks it to sites enabled. And it's a much better system than putting all this stuff in Apache Conf, right?
Right.
Because then you can manage them as items instead of like this monolithic file. Okay, so we're back here. The next thing we're going to install is MySQL. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I skipped something. Passenger enable. So Passenger is an interesting... project that is essentially mod Rails, lets you run your Ruby on Rails in Apache, through Apache, and it's available as a gem, but it's kind of weird because gems is a package that distributes Ruby code, but in this case it's going to distribute code that gets compiled. So is it a source package or an binary package? It gets a little weird. What I would recommend you do if you wanted to install Pasture and you have any control over your infrastructure, you would not do it this way. What you would do is you would build it once and package it with your favorite package manager app, or dpackage, and then through your own private repos, you just serve that out. So in this case, what we're going to do is we're going to run the passenger load, which got installed with the gem that we just installed. And that's going to build a bunch of stuff. And at the end of that, it's going to have this .so file, which I'm sure if you've managed any modules in Apache, you're familiar with. And then that's a directive to load that module that you would put in apache.conf. Right? And there's also, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but there's a similar idiom to managing the modules on Apache on Ubuntu as there is to managing the sites. So there's a modules available directory. You put all the modules available, then you run the exec here, which is enable this mod, and then it's going to put a symlink that is going to be in the modules enabled. Makes sense, right? And then you also need to have another little conf file, which here is going to be templated. I didn't show this template. I'm going to show some other templates later, but it's a simple two-liner that tells Apache where the Ruby executable lives and where the Rails executable live. So Apache can do its magic and get those. So that's the conf, and that's just, if you go learn how Apache's managed on Debian, that will make perfect sense. All this available on my GitHub. Does anyone use Git? So on GitHub lil.idea, all this code's available, so you can look at it. It's also available on the EC2 instance, which I'll tell you about we saw it earlier, but I'll explain it for the streaming in a minute. So you can go poke around at all these modules and run them and play with them. And then Pasture installs another define. It's pretty straightforward. What it's going to do is run the, I think some got out of order. Or no, it didn't. It's the first thing here, the define. And then Pasture install, in this case, that's where it's going to grab the gem. And then this is another thing. This is like where things break down. And this is about the tribes thing, right? In a lot of organizations, you probably don't experience this if you're doing academics as much. But if you're working in an organization that has both developers and sysadmins, there's often this tension. And like this, like they they're not the same tribe, is all I'm saying, right? So in this case, these developers, and they're great developers, they made mod Rails and they put it in gems, and then when you build this thing, you have to interact with it. But what you need to do to interact with that is hit enter twice with like no other data. And it's just like, hi, I'm this little ASCII screen and I have like this blue thing, and then do you really want to do this? Really? Well, I'm not even gonna ask you. Just hit enter, and then when it's done, it's like you have to enter again. I don't know why. Maybe someone made a user story. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that idiom, but I don't want to get too off the tracks right now. So then this is back to the idempotents. It's going to create the file that we already saw being moved into the directory. Now we're going to install MySQL. Pretty straightforward. Packages, blah, blah, blah. MySQL client, MySQL server, libmysql, dev, install them. Then we're going to set up databases. This is for Rails to operate. It needs to have three databases, a dev, test, and production database, and that's just how Rails internals work. This is a way to do that with this database define. I'm going to define all three of those later with parameters. So it's pretty straightforward to understand. It's going to run the command create database unless that database exists. And I can also drop databases. It's going to run drop database unless that database doesn't exist, using that same idiom of ensure present or ensure absent. Ruby MySQL is a gem that Ruby needs. It's basically the bindings for Ruby to talk to MySQL. And now we're going to get to the bottom of this. Rails setup, we're going to actually get Rails. In this case, we're going to parameterize the Rails gem that we install with the version that we need to match for application. So that's pretty straightforward substitution. In the idiom for packages, ensure absent will get rid of a package, ensure present will install the latest package, and install a version will pin it to that package.
Okay, that's great, but what if I have version 212 installed? Or better yet, maybe I have 223 installed, and I'm trying to make sure that it's 222. How does Puppet deal with that?
So with gems in particular, you can have more than one version of gems installed. So you could actually install both of them. So if you're installing system packages and you ensure it's a certain version, then it's going to, using whatever the native package manager supports, and that, you know, mileage may vary on different systems, it's going to try to pin it to that package. It's going to tell that native package manager, make it be this package through whatever mechanism that's abstracted at the bottom. And if that package manager supports it or it's been implemented right, which sometimes break down, but I think it's going to be pretty solid on Ubuntu. It's going to try to make it that version. So then Rails install is the last define. This is all Railsisms. If you've never installed Rails, you might not have seen this, but if you have, then you've done it a million times. It's going to make a directory. I choose var Rails just because I don't know why. It seems like a good place. And it's going to put that with the user that Apache runs as, and then it's going to run this command that's going to install Rails with the name of the application, and then it's going to configure that with the database. So you have to tell the Rails application where your databases live and how to connect to them, and then it's going to set up the virtual host with the name for that site that Apache needs. And then it's going to enable that virtual host with the define that we already saw in the Apache class. These are the templates. So this is a template that is going to use to configure the Rails app. This is YAML. I don't know if you're familiar with that data format. It's essentially going to say, here's how you log in. These are the databases. You'll notice that I use the super secure default password for the root user, Rocket. And then it's going to set up the virtual host. This is another template. This is ERB. If you're doing Ruby stuff, you've seen this a million times, but you guys probably haven't. And it's pretty simple substitution. So here it's going to substitute in the server name that we put in as a virtual host and the name of the application. So it's going to be var Rails, the name of our application, in public. And that's where Apache is going to mount it. And then your server's ready. And if you guys go look on that URL, I think you should see that the Rails stack should be running.
It's up now.
It's up? Okay. There you go. Server's ready. Now, the reason this is interesting and important is, and particularly when you start thinking about virtualization and EC2, is I can make API calls and get servers, right? And even internally, if you start to set up, and this transition's happening, if you start to set up, you know, VMware and some of these more complicated systems, like a lot of people are virtualizing their internal infrastructure just as much, right? So you can bring up new images with whatever you want and then build them to be whatever you want. Now, if you're a sysadmin, and I didn't really go through this, but we'll talk about this more in the end, there's this way to, like, try to do this with images and managing versions of images, and that's a path to hell, I assure you. And we'll talk about that by the end of it. Well, the nice thing about a virtual machine is you can't tell that it's a virtual machine, right? So if you're just running, so some people have set up things to manage those hypervisors with Puppet, but then underneath those virtual machines, you could configure them just like they're normal machines, right? So this goes back to what I said at first. This is something you guys probably aren't as familiar with, but T-A-T-F-T, pronounced Taft, because the T is silent, stands for testing all the effing time. And that's an idiom that the Ruby guys have kind of embraced. But it kind of breaks down when you start to talk about things like servers, because the time scales are different, right? Like if you install some package, if you build a package, then it might take minutes. where if you're doing, you know, test-driven development, you want to be able to run hundreds of tests, you know, at least 10 tests in like a fraction of a second. So you're working on this code, and your cycle, your feedback cycle is much shorter. When you start to build servers, it just breaks down. Furthermore, because the language, the Puppet language is declarative, then you're trying to make, if you're doing really good test sort of methodology, your test should be declarative, but now you have code that's declarative and tests that are declarative. Like, it doesn't even make sense. You're basically saying 1 = 1, and it doesn't tell you anything, and it's not even ground truth, right? So you need to install, make sure it works, and so like the whole thing breaks down. You guys aren't as familiar with this idiom, so you're probably looking at me like, what the hell is this guy talking about? But if you're moving from more of a development environment, like developing Ruby, developing Rails, and you're, you know, running RSpec and running hundreds of tests, you know, every couple minutes to make sure your development's moving in the direction it should be, then you move to doing Puppet, you're basically kind of forced back to this code and fix paradigm, which is how most software is written from the beginning of time, but it's actually not as awesome as test-driven development. But I just want to point that out. Ideas, when I showed this slide at the Ruby conference, I was basically begging people to like give me, if you can figure out some slick way to test the code versus the infrastructure, I'd love to hear them, but I think the fact is it just breaks down, and your test cycles are going to be however long it takes to run those Puppet manifest, and then make sure that stuff's set up. So one of the things people have done is set up continuous integration. Are you guys familiar with like continuous integration type stuff? So you basically run a server that every time there's changes, it's going to run all the Puppet manifest, and then it's going to check the spec. The specification, you could use RSpec, but instead of running code and mock objects, it's going to actually shell out to the machine and make sure. So these are my web servers. I want my web servers to be running XYZ, and it's going to look on the systems themselves and say that's running. And then if you break it, you'll know, because the continuous integration will tell you. And that matters if you're running infrastructure, right? If you're running web servers and you know, you want to change something in the system over here, you check that into the Puppet code before it gets to production. Because going back to infrastructure as code, now, hopefully, and, you know, everyone probably breaks this rule every once in a while, but you don't really want to move from whatever you just did on your laptop to production environment if you're running an application. And now that your infrastructure is code, you probably don't want whatever you just committed to get deployed directly to your environment. And the way people run Puppet, which we'll talk about a little later, probably after the slides are done, the cycle is automated so that when you commit to the central repository for your production environment, it gets propagated. And that could be potentially hundreds or thousands of machines. And so like one little mistake and you could bring down a lot of your infrastructure. So now you have to think about your infrastructure as an application, and that requires some sort of discipline and hygiene and setting up some sort of development, test, stage workflow to move those changes into your production environment. But Puppet is a very sysadminy tool, but it's written in Ruby, so you have to have kind of this domain and this mindset of both sides. And if you, on my blog, I have a couple, because I'm basically a developer by circumstance, we'll say. If you read my blog, that might make more sense. And then there's my partners who were more from the sysadmin, although Luke's probably right like on the edge between both worlds now. But there's sort of like this collision where you could have like confusion and contention. But there's also a great synergy when you start talking about, you know, things are code. And so in a lot of places, I don't know what you guys do or what you guys use, but a lot of sysadmin organizations, they don't use version control, right? They don't use a lot of the things that developers take for granted, but there's an opportunity to, instead of thinking like, that's not my tribe, that's not what I do, to say there's a good reason to do that and learn the lessons. So the developers can learn lessons from the sysadmins can learn lessons for developers. It's actually, particularly when you start talking about web infrastructure, is particularly important because the systems that you're running, that's not the mail server that can go down, right? That's the business value. That's the value chain of that organization. And if you have an application that does something important and provides value, and the developers don't understand the infrastructure and the implications of what they do on the infrastructure, particularly when you start talking about data and all this other stuff, then you can literally crush your servers with things that developers work great on their desk, right? And because of the logic and the usage pattern, when you put that on the production environment, it's going to bring everything down. And I don't know if you guys have seen this, but I have done it. Yeah, it works on my machine, right?
Why don't we just run everybody over to your machine?
Yeah. Well, I'll show you a joke at the end. It's a video online that it's pretty funny. If you're listening to this, then you should Google Giles Boquette, Ruby, and a light bulb, and watch the video because it is great. And that's a little plug for Giles. So we have this collision. We have, and so I was just saying how the developers have to understand the infrastructure, but conversely, the sysadmins also has to understand the application when you get in this situation. So the way that you set up your stuff, the way that you analyze the spikes in load, that has implications for the application. And getting developers and sysadmins to solve those problems together is win-win. And like trying to keep everything walled and siloed is epic fail. So there's sort of this evolution. I love this picture. I think like there's certain things that are happening with both the Puppet project itself and web infrastructure and a lot of interesting things that sort of involve all four of these categories. And we could kind of philosophize about that, but there's basically like things are changing. The way that you build infrastructure today is going to be different tomorrow. And what you can do today, you couldn't do 5 years ago. Right now, anyone with a credit card can bring up 20 servers on EC2 in 5 minutes. That's how long it takes to boot. Well, I mean, that's the upper bound probably, but you could have 20 servers doing whatever you want. That's power. That's the ability to do experiments. That's the ability to deliver value that you probably didn't have 5 years ago, right? So that's the clouds, and that's the change that's coming. That's the opportunity that's there. And the reason you asked earlier why you'd want Amazon to run your infrastructure, so you don't have to do it. So you don't have to plug in cables. And is that what you want to do?
Your office is the coffee shop. It's George Castro.
Right. So George Castro, he sent a tweet to Luke a long time ago that said, people have finally seen, they're starting to figure out the Puppet gets you to the pub by 4. Note that I have been at this pub since 2. So it's really what you're talking about is figuring out that if you're doing things declaratively with Puppet and you're using virtualization and some of these things are happening, then you're not pulling cables. Obviously, somewhere someone probably has to plug some stuff in, but at the end of the day, it gives you the ability to think about things at a high level and manipulate this stuff in ways that you never could do before, right? And then this is another Rubyism, and this is particularly a Mountain West Ruby Conference idiom, and it's probably going to make no sense to you guys at all, but it is what it is. It's Darth Vader in a sombrero. And it would take too long to explain, but if you ever go to Mountain West Ruby Conference and you're doing a talk, I want to see Darth Vader and sombreros in subliminal messages. Mark my words.
Darth Vader and
sombreros.
And that's the presentation I gave for Mountain West Ruby Conference yesterday, and that brings me to the questions portion of the presentation.
One of the things that comes up currently in my job is that I have testers who don't know how to test, and we talk about testing all the effing time, and I'm more interested in, the developers seem to do a good job of testing of their own code, but they're only doing unit testing and a few other things like that. How, in the sense of what Puppet can do, can it help with regard to like forcing people to understand where their tests are going wrong in that sense?
So this is a big topic, and this is something I'm interested in. My other kind of role in thinking about this stuff is process and methodology and testing and skills, right? So unit testing is a skill. Testing all the effing time is actually a skill and a discipline. And I'll swear if you meet me on the street, but I'm in Salt Lake City and I'm streaming, so I'm doing the best I can here. The question you're asking, I think that's sort of, I mean, there's certain things PUPA can do. It can provide stability for those, because a lot of times you have, in some organizations, you have a huge discrepancy between what's in production and what's in the test and development environments, and that can lead to a lot of nightmares, because what works in one doesn't work in the other, and that can cause you problems. So you can provide that sort of stability. As far as teaching testers how to test, that's its own problem, right? And PUPA is not going to solve that for you.
I'm not necessarily suggesting that Puppet can solve that. More along the lines of, is there things that I can make sure Puppet provides so that if they do have failures, like I said, like more of a consistent environment in my test environment versus production.
What it allows you to do...
So that when I'm actually having the testing, they're really testing real stuff and they can actually feel like they are.
Then I think the answer is yes. Because you can, you know, to whatever degree, the thing that's hardest to do, and Puppet's not going to help you do this, is simulate the usage patterns and the load on sort of web application. But it should do a great job of providing the consistency across. Because what happens in a lot of places, particularly when what we were just talking about before, where you have like the application is treated separately from the infrastructure. So the application might go through this testing process, but then the configuration on the production servers, those are often just done, right? And they're not the same. Often they're different machines. Like, right? There's a lot more RAM. There's a lot more CPU. So there's
generally one off. Like, you have one application that's a different version of the test.
Right. Exactly. So being able to provide that consistency is a big win. When you start talking about virtualization, which we mentioned earlier, one of the things that we're doing some projects for people where we're actually providing mechanisms. So it's one thing to have like this test environment and this dev environment, but often some of the tests that people do change the environment, right? So it's nice to get, if you're doing unit tests and you're running those applications and they're, you know, you can clear the memory and bring it back up, but there's this test instance that just sits there forever, and whatever stuff got done to it might affect how the application runs later. So you can use tools like Puppet to rebuild from clean images so that you're testing from a known state. So that's also a pretty big win. Does that answer your question, or is there more? That's a human engineering problem,
yeah,
more than a technology problem. Yeah.
And I just wanted to see if there were essentially tools. So part of my question is, I want to be able to take Puppet, Puppet master the management, my testing environment, and my production environment, and I assume that can easily be done.
There's built-in support for a notion of environments.
Okay.
So you can use environments, but you can also just set them up as separate Puppet masters. There's pros and cons to both approaches, and I know people doing it both ways. You look like you're going to ask a question.
I mean, where the infrastructure is the code. I mean, are you really seeing a great synergy between the developers and the actual people who administrate the sites? Are there really? I can see it maybe.
Okay, so the answer is sort of, and it kind of depends from organization to organization, right? So there's a lot of, and this goes across, I mean, it's really a human engineering problem, just like Clint was talking about. So you have places where there's 10,000 boxes, and there's 200 people that have root, and there's, 20 dev teams, and it's a total, whatever bad word you want to use, that describes a mess, right? And so there's all these politics, and there's all these pathological issues with process and methodology. And so what happens in most of those sort of enterprise-y organizations that can't really get that together is they implement these draconian change management processes, so things just happen really, really, really slowly. The flip side of that is we have a client that runs, and I can't say their name. I wish I could, and hopefully that will get fixed eventually. But they have 10,000 machines. It's all puppetized. They basically have system where the developers writing the applications as part of the application delivery write the Puppet code to manage and configure that application. Right? So now you have a boundary object. You have a shared object that both the operations and systems guys look at and understand, and the developers understand. And so you get, it facilitates this communication between both groups that you don't necessarily have when developers are just throwing things over the wall. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so the developer is actually responsible for writing the code.
And if the application doesn't get, in this particular organization, which I think is like the shining example of how it could and should be, if the developers don't manage that application properly, then it's a bug. They open a bug against the application until that Puppet code works. So that you have a workflow that where everything's vetted at the dev level, then it's vetted at the test level, then maybe
and
staging.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I don't think I can convince my developers
to do that. Well, yeah.
But
it's a human engineering problem. You can't even get your testers to test. What are you talking about? Hey, don't talk bad about testers.
I got
love for testing and testers. I'll come over there. They get no love, and everything's their fault.
Sam, I'm on the other.
No, it's actually the PhD's fault
other
because
extreme.
They won't let me have time to make them test.
Right.
Teach them the right way.
See, I'm on the other extreme. I'm in a real small company. It's me, two developers, all our offices together. It works really well. The thing that I'm interested in this is we run free BSD and virtual machines. We don't have a physical box. Mm-hmm. Everything we do is already in virtual. And I have like a demo box where the sales guy goes out and does a demo with data. And I need to reset the data after he's done a demo and dicked with the database and made a bunch of changes showing. It looks like this, I could set it where I could very easily just rolling it back instantly to fixing the box after he's shown a customer.
Should be able to automate it. Should be able to automate it. Pretty straightforward. You look skeptical.
Yeah. Have you ever, well, you know, it's a nice opponent. It's really nice. Questions like the Puppet Master server. I'm really interested in that, and there wouldn't seem to be a lot of talk about that.
So this, I have a couple other presentations I've done before, and the Puppet Master server, in this particular case, I'm just showing the code,
right.
Because the project itself, so there's other things I didn't tell you guys. So this was all about code. But then there's Puppet infrastructure. So you have a Puppet client, a Puppet master, there's a Puppet executable, and they all kind of do stuff, and they're all kind of flexible, and you can choose different ways to use them.
So with the instance of your EC2 deployment there, you ran just the Puppet executable and said, run the following, just run this. You didn't have a Puppet master feed it to it. It's just, this is the configuration. This is what I wanted. Do it right now.
Yep.
Cobbler
was written for or to integrate with Puppet out of the box.
So, Matt, do you have a presentation at scale about specifically that? Whether or not it was a good or not bad presentation, the intention was to talk about how Cobbler and Puppet were together.
Well, yeah, when you spend a whopping 3 minutes on Cobbler, it really doesn't integrate well, but okay.
What happened?
The guy talked. He talked.
I didn't see this talk, but.
Okay. Quite well. He's a great guy. And his product, Cobbler, is amazing. And I use it at work. And I love it. And I've used it for personal things. I love it. I use it for lots of things. I'm under the, just Puppet is still kind of like this brainchild for me. Like, I'm still trying to understand it completely. Because from what I understand, you have to kind of use it before you actually get it. If that makes any sense.
I think there's some truth to that in almost anything, though.
Yeah. Well, but the thing is like, I understand the concept. I can do with it is so grand, I guess is a way to put it.
Right.
Like, I can think of so many things that I can do with Puppet that it doesn't really have to be, I don't have to have a Puppet Master. I don't have to have these things. I can do it. And, and it's kind of like Ruby's old, it's Play-Doh type methodology you told me about. It's like, it's just this big mess of things that I can do whatever I want with, and I can mold it in the form that I want.
So you want less choices, is what you're saying.
No, I want less choices. That's basically what it is. I can choose how I do it.
Right. But then, like, but then choices, okay.
You
do have to start thinking. Can I just get a what for start thinking? Can we get people to start thinking? Because I think that will fix a lot of problems.
I don't know. Look, that's dangerous.
So the thing I think about is like, okay, so currently the whole deployment of production versus testing versus staging and getting that to be in place is probably going to be a great undertaking as it is. One of the things that I've seen a fair amount in a couple of the projects that I work on are they actually install applications using Puppet. Now, I'm not sure if they're using a Puppet Master or not. I think they are. But they basically just send it to Puppet. Now, how does that actually work? Like, so they just say, go install this thing. And it's just a brand new package that they just built. And it's actually using the package management system underneath. Let's just say it's
So I can only speculate, but let's say you had a package for your application.
Sure.
Right? Which you, like, that sysadmin love is to have, like, native package managers versus, like, Rails deployments.
Well,
it's
using the native package manager at the bottom, obviously.
So if that package has a name and you just have Puppet set to install the latest version and you move that into your private repo that you control and have that pointed at, the next time Puppet runs, it's going to resynchronize, it's going to see there's a new version, and it'll install it.
Oh, okay.
So the default, it doesn't. The default is not to run it as cron. People run it as cron sometimes for other reasons. The default is every 30 minutes it will resynchronize, and so that's where the idempotency comes in. So it's basically going to revalidate all of the settings that you set up, and if a package has changed and there's now a new version, it will roll to that.
How does it synchronize if it doesn't use cron?
It has a daemon, a client. So that's the Puppet D.
Okay, it's client server.
Yeah. But you could people run it in cron, or people just run the executable. So they like do their own for whatever reason, and it's back to the Play-Doh thing. They'll set up instead of having Puppet Master, they'll just rsync the manifest, and then run from the Puppet executable just like I did on the demo. Does that make sense? Yes, Play-Doh.
My poor work, they're going to be having an experiment on Monday. But I have probably the ability to install 4 or 5
So, hold on. Let me bring... So this is just to kind of give you a little more idea about some of it. And this isn't necessarily up to date. There's a lot more people... but this is the presentation that we did for the Ruby Award. So like Google manages their infrastructure, their workstations, the Mac infrastructure with Puppet. Red Hat uses Puppet. Like we said, Cobbler is a great tool. James Turnbull, who's the community manager / release manager for the project. He's like a huge Cobbler fan now. He keeps raving about Cobbler. So you can go from basically, whether you're going to have virtualized instances or something like Cobbler, you can basically go from bare metal to running services in like automated way.
The neatest thing, and I'll mention this too, the neatest thing about Cobbler is it supports everything from all the Linux distributions that they're working on, and they actually have a Windows plan for this next release. And they're looking at like all the BSDs, all the Solaris units, all the other types of units you can think of. So if you can automate it in any form, they Cobbler's going to track it down. And adding Puppet onto it, that's just totally like easy concept to add.
But if you have Cobbler with Windows, there's no way you can Puppet.
I bet in the future I can see a Puppet.
So Puppet's open source, free software, right? So at least once a month, someone comes on the mailing list, and they're like, does it work on Windows? We're like, no. Oh, I'd really like it if it worked on Windows. Well, do you have any money? No, I don't want it that bad. You know, so... I mean, it's just a matter of time and work to do it. Yeah, if you know Windows and you understand the models and the framework, you can go do that. And
that follows the Alan Cox bizarre cathedral townspeople. You guys heard that? You've got the bizarre model and the cathedral model and how software's developed, and you've got really good software developers, which probably make like 3% of the developer population, and you've got everybody else. So then you've got townspeople. These guys don't know how to develop, but they sure do want this. And they're willing to bitch about this and all about that. Who's the vocal majority? It's the townspeople.
I think someone who understood both the model, you know, the framework model, and then what you want to accomplish on Windows. And there's I don't manage Windows. I don't know Windows personally. I'm sure I could learn it if someone gave me a minute. I'm going to be honest, and this is a Ubuntu group, but I used to think that anyone who did anything on Windows or .NET, I just kind of wrote them off. But through other parts of my life, I have learned that there are some smart people that do .NET and do, you know, C# and all this kind of stuff, and I respect them a lot. And I've learned to love and open my heart, to tell you the truth. And so, you know, we're gonna have a little testimonial. But the end of the day, you essentially have people doing what they have to do, right? And there's a ton of people running Windows, and there's a ton of people running that stuff. So more power to them. That's just not what I do. And you know, if someone wants to make it work on Windows, then we have a guy right now that he has his job. If we were able to give him a little bit of money, it's probably like a 2-month project, and it will work on Windows.
There's a lot of money to be made on the Windows side too, for something.
There's a lot of money to be made, maybe because of the philosophy. Like no one on Windows, like everyone on Windows pays for stuff, right? But there's also more competition. There's a lot of GUI tools to manage Windows, and so you kind of need someone who's at the corner, like that is on that border, that has to manage these heterogeneous networks where they have both systems. They see the value of a framework like Puppet, and they have to manage all these Windows systems, perhaps reluctantly, and they're trying to figure out a good way to do that. That's SlideShare.
Yeah, they don't want that. They want
PDFs. I can post PDFs. I actually have a PDF.
Just after some time.
I'll just send you the file right as soon as I finish, and you can put it up. Perfect. The slides are they're PDF'd. Mountain West Ruby Conference, represent. It was at the library, about 230, 250 Rubyists.
Did you do that in the conference rooms in the bottom level?
No, we had that the big theater, auditorium thing.
It's downstairs too.
It seats, you know, maybe 200 something, maybe 300 maybe. And there's people from all over the Mountain West. So people as far as, I know one guy's from Pennsylvania. And then there's speakers from all over, so. It's probably one of the, not to toot the Mountain West horn, but it's an excellent Ruby conference.
So if you're in the channel, I just posted the Mountain Cox article. They drove the bizarre
and the What channel are you guys on?
Ubuntu-Utah?
Okay. Gotcha. So that's Puppet. You can reach me on Twitter, Little Idea. GitHub, Little Idea has all this code.
I have an Identica account too.
I do, little idea on Identica, but I don't use it too much.
I just use Paint, so I just always put it on all of them. So.
But then it's annoying because everyone sees the same thing if they're following you on both, and I don't know.
Yeah, I only follow one, but I use Paint at them, so I set all of them.
Right.
So I don't have to pay attention to those other ones.
Yeah. And I'd imagine the community's just getting bigger and bigger.
So the if you go to Pound Puppet right now, there's probably 200 people, and a lot of those guys are Europeans and Australians. So you can have conversations at 2 a.m. when you're, you know.
It's useful because I do this 4 hours sleep, 8 hours sleep, 4 hours sleep.
There's usually 30 to 50 mail. The average is about 30. So if you count the weekends, sometimes there'll be 40, 50 emails on the user list a day. And the dev list is getting more and more active as well. There's probably, I think last week there was on average 2-3 patches a day from the community. And then, just there's a lot of interest. There's a lot of ideas.
How does that affect you? Because it's you
So the main developer that wrote all this framework is his brainchild, and his labor of love is Luke Canise. If you go to reductivelabs.com, that's our website. Luke's blog is madstop.com, and he talks about the history of Puppet and CF Engine. I don't know if anyone's familiar with CF Engine, but he used to be really into CF Engine and automation, and then he got to the point where he was kind of frustrated with what CF Engine could do, and that was sort of the birthplace of Puppet, and now. I mean, the whole concept of infrastructure as code is becoming more prevalent. There's more ideas. Right now this is Puppet language. There's a project that we're doing that someone wants that will expose a pure Ruby internal DSL to write resources, like the resource I showed you, and add them to the catalog. And I think it's not too far away. And I don't know if it'll be this year, but it'll be pretty soon, that you should be able to add resources to the Puppet catalog with arbitrary logic. Because if you remember the code we just looked at, it's a lot of it's data. So there's some logic, obviously, some conditionals and that kind of stuff, but it's mostly data. And so if you could just represent that as your favorite data format, JSON or whatever, then add through whatever logic, if you like to program in Python or you like to program in whatever, then you could just pass this data into that framework and then have the other logic that's built up. And so you could have things coming from other places and going other places, and it just becomes like this central nexus to manipulate your infrastructure. Because one of the things it's hard to see here, this is configuring one instance, right?
Right.
So, but what you really want to be able to do is orchestrate clusters.
Right.
You want to be able... Right, and so then you start to have not just the intra-host configurations, but inter-host configurations that you need to manage. So you need to be able to say, these 100 servers connect to this database. This load balancer is load balancing these servers. And so you have to be able to coordinate that with Puppet. And you can do most of that right now. There's a few places where it could be better, but it's definitely progressing, and I think you're going to see a lot of movement in that direction.
Where is Reductive Labs?
Wherever I'm standing. No, just kidding. Technically, it's Luke's house on the stationary or whatever. Yeah, which is in Nashville, Tennessee, and I don't know what the future holds for sure, but there's a good chance that we'll try to get the headquarters in Portland. That's where I met Luke a long time ago. Say again? There's three of us. Reductive Labs is three musketeers right now, and that's Luke, Teo, and myself. And then there's also some people from the community that we are probably going to bring onto the team as circumstances permit. And I think you'll see the team double in size in probably 3-4 months. And then by the end of the year, who knows?
But it's probably going to take a long time.
would contribute that you could actually make a goal?
I worked full-time on this project for a year, and I paid my mortgage, and you know, God willing, I could pay my mortgage this year, and we'll see where it goes.
I was curious because I helped with the startup tanks, and there's a lot of Python development and that agenda.
I worked for two startups. One of them's still kicking. One of them went from 80 people to about 15 people in 9 months, and the, you know, 2-3 years before that, they'd burned through $26 million and had essentially nothing to show for it then. Some of the other circumstances, I mean, we're getting into a totally different area now, but there's other circumstances that make some of this particularly difficult. But honestly, for us right now, because of what Puppet provides and the value that it provides and the other circumstances of economics, it's almost counter-cyclical. So we're getting more interest than we were. I mean, and part of it's the normal growth curve, but I think that in some cases it's easier. So if you look at the commercial space, the obvious, there's other projects that can do some of this sort of policy-based automation. Blade Logic and Opsware kind of jump to the front of that pack, but there's other tools as well, and those guys to get those tools installed is quite expensive, and if you've had those tools installed, then you know you're paying these yearly support or licenses on that software, and you're like, how can I save myself some money? Oh wait, there's something that I can use that doesn't cost $250,000 or $500,000. Total cost of ownership.
Yeah, cost of employing the guy and not paying for licensing.
Well, I think the price.
Licensing per year, and you're paying for all the units versus a person, it can be more money for one unit than it is for that person. And if you're managing with Puppet versus some other tool, it can be immensely different.
The price of open source is expertise, right? So
you pay for one person as opposed to paying for 10 licenses.
Sure.
Right, but you have to have an expert person.
Or you can pay me and I will train you. And it will be awesome.
See, and that's the cost of the employee right there.
Any other questions for Andrew?
Well, thanks for having me. I'm a little tired, so hopefully that was intelligible.
Thank you for listening to Hacker Public Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net. So head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.